All right, we're ready for Mark chapter 10 as we make our way through our survey. This is the outline that we're following from L.A. Stopher, and we are in the third section as he is making his way from Galilee to Judea. And that will bring, we'll bring that section to a close, and next time we'll begin the events at Jerusalem in chapter 11. And so this is an expansion of that section, and we are dealing with the last two of those. There was the final events and teaching in Galilee, and then Jesus comes to the borders of Judea, and then he begins his ministry, begins his journey toward Jerusalem, has his face set toward Jerusalem. We'll say more about that here at verse 1 here in just a second. To review where we've been quickly, chapter 1 was the beginning of the Galilean ministry, and so today we have the end of the Galilean ministry, if you want to flag that somehow. And the beginning of another ministry, which we label as the Perean ministry. We'll say more about that at verse 1 in a moment. Chapter 2. Yeah, conflict with the Pharisees. And that conflict spilled over into chapter 3. So chapter 3 dealt with the, about the Sabbath healing. Chapter 4, parables. Chapter 3 dealt with the three miracles. In chapter 5, chapter 5 is where I meant to go. That was my fault. Chapter 6, there was John beheaded miracles. Very good. Chapter 7, more controversy. Yeah, and more miracles. Very good. And then chapter 8, Peter's confession and discipleship, at least as we have outlined, or Stopher outlined, that his outline points toward that conclusion in chapter 8. Now, chapter 9 last time was, that's chapter 17 and 18 of Matthew for your parallel. All right, here's chapter 10. I call this chapter divorce and remarriage. Is that the only thing there? No. I try to give chapter titles that will remind me of a key point in the chapter. There's, for example, other things like the rich young ruler or the blind man healed, etc. But the teaching on divorce and remarriage, this reminds me this is a parallel account to what chapter in Matthew? Matthew 19. Luke 16 is parallel in principle, but it's not parallel in the event. And the same thing is true with Matthew 5, not parallel in the event, but it is parallel in principle. So the parallel account is found in Matthew, and we'll talk more about that here in just a second. All right, now we're going to come back to the outline here in just a second. Let's go to verse 1, because verse 1 gives us a little transition point. And verse 1 said that he arose and came to the region of Judea by the other side of Jordan. And so you might flag that and make a marginal note that the other side of the Jordan is Perea. So Jesus has been in Galilee. If you can see my little dot, I think that's red. Anyway, he comes from Galilee. And so they generally didn't go through Samaria. Why? John 4. The Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. They were a mixed breed. And so going around Samaria, that puts them over into Perea. So we call this the Perean ministry. He's going to make his way down to Jericho. We'll come to that and blow that up a little bit for us to see later. And then on down to Jerusalem. And that's where he comes for his Passion Week, as we call it, the final week in the life of Christ. Now, let's make a note to the margin of our text. He leaves Galilee for the final time here at verse 1. He's been to Galilee. He's left it, went up to Caesarea Philippi, etc. Went to Judea, come back. And this is the last time he's leaving Galilee. This is the last time he's leaving, for what that may be worth. And then the second thing you might note is the Perean ministry. More details of that is given in Luke than in the other Gospels. So Luke 9, verse 51 through 19 and 28. I'll give those again if you want that. Luke 9, 51 through 19 and 28. That's a large segment of Luke is about this Perean ministry. Make sense? So you say, I want to know what all went on. Well, we're about to see what went on there. This teaching about divorce and remarriage was in the Perean ministry. We're going to see more when we get to Luke. So he's leaving Galilee for the last time. All right, now we try to flag parallel accounts. So concerning the teaching on divorce and remarriage, our only parallel account, not the only passage that deals with divorce and remarriage, but we're talking about the same event recorded by another writer, is in Matthew 19, which we are very familiar with. And we'll flag some differences there as we go along. So let's work our way through this now in verses 1 through 12. Matthew's account is a little different. It's different in order. It's different in what it includes. And we'll flag that as we go along. So the Pharisees came to him. Now this is in the region of Perea. And the Pharisees come and they ask the question at verse 2, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Now what's not included here that Matthew includes was the question was, can a man divorce his wife for any reason, for just any reason? So Matthew adds that point. And the order now of how Jesus responds is reversed from Matthew's account. In Matthew's account, he goes back to Genesis 2 and talks about the beginning before he talks about Moses' tolerance in Deuteronomy 24. See that? Remember that? You might turn over there and take a look at that. He deals with Genesis 2, that is, the creation at the beginning, and then he comes to Deuteronomy 24, and then he deals with his teaching. In Mark's account, he deals with Deuteronomy 24 first, Genesis 2, and then his teaching. See the difference in order? Is there any significance to that? No, it's just a little interesting observation that Jesus does. So Jesus, as if Mark was the only account that we had, it seems that Jesus raises the question about Deuteronomy and about Moses. But according to Matthew's account, it was the Pharisees who, based upon what Jesus had said from Genesis 2, then why did Moses give the command to writing a divorcement? That's what prompted that. Does that make sense? All right, Matthew, Mark didn't tell us that. So I'm trying to harmonize the accounts is what I'm trying to do here. So he said, what did Moses command you? And they said, Moses permitted to write a certificate of divorce and to dismiss her. Now that's their concept. In other words, Moses gave permission. Did he tolerate? Jesus used the word suffer, which means to allow. And Jesus will comment upon that just briefly, but not as much as Matthew's account does. But their concept was Moses commanded us, according to Matthew's account, Moses commanded us to give a writing of divorce. And that's not what Moses did. That's not what Deuteronomy 24 said. We went through Deuteronomy 24 recently as we came through Matthew. We're not going to go back through all the details of that. So let's go on to verse 5. What's Jesus' comment about Deuteronomy 24? They said Moses commanded. And yet, let me just summarize what Deuteronomy 24 said. Deuteronomy 24 was contingency law. That's clearer in your New American Standard Version and some others that I don't have before me than it is perhaps in the King James. And the contingency law was simply that if a man divorces his wife for uncleanness, didn't say he could divorce her for uncleanness, but if he does, whatever that is, I don't really care what uncleanness is, because it was not a command. It was not a permission. It was if a man puts away his wife for uncleanness and she goes and marries another man and then he puts her away or dies, she cannot come back to the first husband. That's all it said. If this happens, here's what you can't do. They worded it as Moses gave a commandment of divorce. He didn't give a commandment of divorce. It was in the commands, but it wasn't a command to divorce for uncleanness. That's not what Deuteronomy 24 said. All right, with that in mind, Jesus, though, says at verse 5, because of the hardness of your hearts, he wrote this precept. Matthew's account said he suffered. In other words, did God tolerate divorce? Yes. Did he approve? No. Did he command it? No. But he tolerated divorce in the Old Testament. Acts 17, at the times of this ignorance God winked at. Good commentary on that. All right, now I'm interested in verse 6, and I know I'm kind of hurrying because we're trying to get through the chapter, but from the beginning of creation, Matthew adds, it was not so. That's his point. I know that's his point because that's what Matthew recorded for us. In other words, this toleration of divorce, the permission of divorce, was not in harmony with the law from the beginning. From the beginning of creation, it was not so. What happened at the beginning of creation? Well, he made them male and female. But let's pause and let's go to a question. And what does verse 6 tell us about refuting theistic evolution? Theistic evolution says God created everything, created man and woman, but it all happened by the process of evolution over millions and millions and billions of years. What does verse 6 tell you? Made male and female at the beginning. Now, if theistic evolution be true, or the time gap theory be true, then man was created closer to our time than at the beginning. But Jesus said it was at the beginning. But Jesus says it was at the beginning of creation. At the beginning, not just the beginning, but at the beginning of creation, he made them male and female. Does that make sense? All right, question number 4. What does verse 6 tell us about refuting the idea of the 6 days of creation was millions of years in length, and now we're living in the seventh day? That's part of the gap theory. And the simple answer to that is man was created at the beginning, but if that principle be true, he's closer to our time. If we're living in the seventh day and all of the others were millions of years, and we're in that last millions and millions of years, man was created closer to our time than at the beginning. And Jesus said it was at the beginning. All right, enough about evolution. What did he say in verses 6, 7, 8, and 9 in answer to the question, can a man divorce his wife? And the implication was just for any reason. His answer is no. 4 reasons. Let's get them. We listed these in Matthew 19. They're listed here. The first one is God made them male and female, one man for one woman for life. If that's true, you can't divorce your mate just for any reason. Second reason, a man should be joined or cleave, the King James says. It's a word from which we get our word glue. Be joined to his wife or cleave to his wife. The third reason is they become one flesh. They're united as one. That describes far more than intimate relationship, I'm convinced. And then verse 9, God has joined them together. So there are 4 reasons why the answer is no. Jesus doesn't just say, no, you can't divorce just for any reason. But here are 4 reasons from which you are to deduce no is the answer. All right. Having said that, verse 10 says, and in the house the disciples ask again about the same matter. Now, Mark doesn't record what Matthew tells us. Matthew tells us, they said, if such be with a man and his wife, and at that point, they had already heard the discussion of verse 12, 11, and 12. So Matthew's got that. And Mark's got that in a different order. After they had already heard 11 and 12, they asked, if such be with a man and his wife, it would be better not to marry. And Jesus said, not everyone can receive that saying. That's his Matthew's account, but some can. Now, I'm just trying to flag the differences here. Now, in verse 11 and 12, this has to do with who can divorce and who can remarry. Now, what's missing? There's 2 things missing in Mark's account we find in Matthew's account. All right, the exception phrase. So Mark is dealing with the rule and not the exception. Sometimes we just need to focus on the rule. Luke 16 focuses on the rule and not the exception. Only 2 passages mention the exception. They are Matthew 19, verse 9, and Matthew 5, 32. Very good. All right. That's the only 2. This is dealing with the rule. So that the exception, there's something else missing. And then something added. We'll get to the added part, but there's something else missing that we find over in Matthew, and we find it also in Luke. Mark talks about a man putting away his wife, but Matthew adds one who is put away. Remember that? At the end of verse 9, the end of Luke 16, 18. That second independent clause is found in those two texts, but missing here. I don't mean it's missing like somebody took it out. Jesus didn't add that. That's not his focal point. Does that make sense? Now, what did Mark add that is not found in any other text? Verse 12. First, what did he add? And the second question is going to be, why did he add it? Added it, made an application to the woman. Why does Mark mention that but Matthew doesn't? Yeah, but he's writing to a Gentile audience, and therefore it was tolerated and accepted among the Gentiles. So you might flag verse 12, this is because of a Gentile audience. All right, so the question was, can you divorce just for any reason? And Jesus then gives his answer to that. All right, let's move on from that. That's pretty... Yes. Good point. All right, let's talk about Jesus, the little children coming to Jesus, beginning at verse 13 through 16, and look at the parallel accounts, or at least flag them. Matthew talks about this, and Luke talks about this. John doesn't talk about anything that we're talking about today. But we have it in Luke, and we have it in Matthew. Now, we'll try to flag what is dealt with there as we go along. One writer, I think it perhaps may have been Linsky in Matthew's account of this, that made the observation that if marriage is important, then children are also important. It may have been Linsky or Hendrickson or someone, I forgot, who made the point that in the previous section, women were elevated and honored and not just something to be disposed of at will. And now children are elevated. I'm not sure that was the point. I think there's another point to be made that we're going to flag. But they brought children to him that he might touch them. Now, quite often, people were being brought to Jesus that he might touch them to heal them. That's not the point. Verse 16 says they're wanting him to touch them that he might bless them. That's the idea. I think that this story is partly told to highlight what we've been highlighting since chapter 8, and that is the dullness of the disciples. They're not getting it. They don't understand it. So when little children are brought to him, the disciples rebuke them and those that brought them, and Jesus was greatly displeased with that. He's not just displeased, he was greatly displeased. That argues and points to that dullness that we've been painting since chapter 8 and 9 and now in chapter 10. What this does is give Jesus an opportunity to teach about the nature of the kingdom that we're going to see dealt with all through the chapter. Hopefully get to that and flag several things in the chapter about their misunderstanding. So it's an opportunity to teach about the nature of the kingdom. So Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me. Don't forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." And so there's been a lot made of that, that some have argued, even some of our brethren who've argued, that you could take money out of the treasury and help non-Christians who are children because they're saints. And they argue from this text. I think you'll find that in the Hires-Bingham debate. Be that as it may, I don't agree with that. Errol Bingham was a good man. I don't agree with his conclusion on that. And some have argued that the infants are in the kingdom. Little children are in the kingdom. That's not the point. Look at verse 15. Luke adds this. Mark adds this. Matthew does not add this. So here's your explanation of that. Verse 15. that whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it. Here's his explanation of what it means that of such is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of what he's talking about, here is the nature of the citizens of the kingdom. Here's the kind of people that make up the kingdom. It's like those who are humble and teachable and moldable and submissible like little children are. It's these kind of people, not infants, but people who are like unto children. See the point? And so Matthew adds that, and then he took them in his arms and he blessed them. And so it's not just a matter of Jesus pays some attention to kids, and so this is an interesting little cute story, but Jesus uses this as an opportunity to teach about the nature of the kingdom, which they did not understand. There again is your dullness and a lesson on the nature of the kingdom. Make sense? All right. Now, let's go to the rich young ruler, and we'll make two points about him. But if you want to know parallel accounts, we find it in Matthew 19, which we have studied. We'll get that again in Luke 18, 18 through 30. There's some information in those accounts that we don't have here, and we'll flag that as we go along. So let's talk about the rich young ruler and what we know about him. Mark indicates that he comes running to Jesus. Every time I look at this story, I try to picture myself as standing off to the side and I'm traveling with Jesus, and I've never seen this before, and I'm kind of impressed when I see a man running to Jesus. Aren't you? He didn't just kind of, somebody's dragging him, he's running to Jesus. What does he say when he comes? Good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He has an interest in spiritual things. He's more than interested in spiritual things, he's interested in going to heaven. I'm really impressed now. We'll come back to our impression of him, but look at verse 18. Why do you call me good? None is good but one, that is God. He's not rebuking him for calling him good. What's Jesus actually saying? I'm deity. Do you understand who you're asking? When I give you the answer to the question, do you understand this is coming as a divine answer? Will you accept it as a divine answer? You've called me good, and there's none to be called good but God. He didn't say, I'm not good, but do you understand by calling me good that is an affirmation of deity? I am good. I am God. I am deity. He made his claim. Now, here's what deity said. He said, do you know the commandments? And he enumerates a number of those, like do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not bear false witness, honor your father and mother. And what was his answer? All right, now that tells me something about his childhood. If he kept it from his youth, what does that say about his parents? They must have taught him. They must have started young. Must have instilled the principles, must have read to him from the law and told him we need to follow the law. So he had a good upbringing. He's interested in spiritual things. He's eager to get an answer. I'm impressed so far, aren't you? Now, we don't know anything else about him. Just pretend we're standing off to the side seeing that. I'm greatly impressed. He said, not only has he been taught since his youth, but he had obeyed these laws. If he's telling the truth, and he must be. Because Jesus didn't say there's 10 things you like. He said there's one thing you like. We'll get to that in a second. But all that I've kept from my youth up. But then Jesus looked at him. He looks intently. He does that to his disciples later. He looks intently at him, and you might underline, he loved him. Whatever deity says to us that we lack or we need to do or command we need to obey, it is driven out of love. So when he says there's something you lack, there's something missing, there's something you need to correct, there's something more you need to do, that wasn't said out of anger, wasn't said out of hatred, it was said out of love. He loved him and said, one thing you lack. Now, Mike Flagg, Matthew adds that it was the young man who asked, is there anything else that I lack? That's a paraphrase, that's not an exact quote. I've done all that from my youth up. Is there anything else? In other words, I'll be glad to do anything else you suggest to me. I'm really impressed. You don't get these kind of people come along every day, do you? You don't get this every day. Wow, this is an impressive young man. And Jesus said to him, there's one thing that you lack, and what does he say to him? Yeah. He needed to get rid of his wealth more than the poor needed the wealth. Would you agree with that? Now, let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 24. This is a man who trusts in riches. It's not that he's rich. That's not the problem. And the answer, though, at verse 22, his response was, he went away sad and he was grieved because he had great possessions. In other words, he was willing to do the convenient. This was difficult because he didn't want to sacrifice it. And he let one thing, just one thing, keep him out of heaven. Could I be letting one thing, just one thing, that's all it is, just one thing, keep me out of heaven? That's a powerful question. All right, now let's look at the question of who can be saved. And Mark gives us a little more information than Matthew does here. The disciples are concerned about this. He said, Jesus looked around and said to the disciples, how hard is it for those who have riches to enter the kingdom of God? Well, on the surface, that sounds like rich people can't be saved. How did the disciples respond? Oh, wow. They're astonished. You really mean rich people can't be saved? Jesus qualified. Here's his explanation. What's his explanation? Verse 24. Yeah, might underline trust in riches. It is not the fact that they're rich, but it's the fact they trust in riches. Their emphasis is in the wrong place. They cannot enter the kingdom of God. Then Jesus illustrates, it's easier what? You think he means that literally? Yeah. Some have argued that the eye of a needle is a real narrow place that you take your camel through and he gets stuck. And so you push and you shove and it's hard, but you can finally push him on through. If that's the case, Jesus is saying a person who trusts in riches going to have a hard time, but you push and shove and you get him in. That's not what he's saying. He's saying it's impossible. Matthew and Mark use a sewing needle term. Luke, being a physician, uses a suture needle. It's a literal needle. You say, well, it's impossible to take a camel and push him through the eye of that needle. That's the point. You got it now. It is impossible. As long as you trust in riches, you can get that camel through the eye of the needle a whole lot easier than you can that rich man into heaven. It's not going to work. Now, look at verse 26. They were astonished beyond measure, saying to themselves, who then can be saved? But notice the wording, entering the kingdom, verse 26. I take verse 26. Let me just conjecture a little bit, and you can accept it or reject it, that I think verse 26 is perhaps reflecting their thinking of an earthly kingdom again. That the rich cannot enter the kingdom. They're thinking this earthly kingdom that Jesus is going to establish, and you're saying that people who trust in riches can't get into the kingdom that you're going to be the head of and reign here. And you, is that what you're saying? So they're astonished. This is amazing. And Jesus looked at them. That's intently. Same word I think used back earlier. And he said, with men it is impossible, but with God all things are possible. I think his point is the issue rests upon dependence upon God. Does that make sense? And willingness to submit to him. God doesn't make it hard for the rich. It's their own greed that made it hard. That's the point he's making. Now, it gets even richer. Look at verse 28. What did Peter say? Yeah, we've sacrificed all to follow you. And what Mark doesn't add, that Matthew adds, is he adds, what will we get? What are we going to get out of that? That's a hireling spirit. A hireling spirit. Now, Jesus gives two answers to that. And he first says that there's no one that's left houses and brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and wife and children and lands for my sake and the gospel's who should not receive 100-fold now. In other words, you're going to receive more than you sacrifice. You want to know what you got? You're going to get out of this, Peter? You're going to get more than you sacrifice. You may lose family, but you're going to gain more family, spiritual. You may lose riches, but you'll gain more riches, spiritually. And at the end of verse 30, you're going to receive eternal life. Now, let's make a marginal note here that may be helpful to us. Matthew inserts the parable of the workers of the vineyard at this point. Mark does not. Mark is that fast-paced writer. He doesn't have time for that. It's not that that's unimportant, but that's an important parable. Because that parable is the explanation of verse 31. The first shall be last and the last shall be first. In other words, all will be equal. Those that have agreed to work for this period of time, and those who work for this period of time, they get paid, they're all equal. So Peter, you're not going to get any more than anybody else who sacrificed half as much. That's the point. The first shall be last and last shall be first. Matthew 21 is your explanation of that. All right. Now, any questions on that? Yeah. Yeah, you're going to get even. And he's about to say more about that. You're going to get more than what you're asking for. Good point. All right, let's get the next section here. Jesus then tells about his death and his resurrection beginning at verse 32. Now, that's found in Matthew. That's also found in Luke. And we'll try to flag where our differences are there here in just a second. Let's get to that section and see what the point is being made. As they're going on the road, going up to Jerusalem, that has to do with altitude, not direction, but altitude. They're going up toward Jerusalem, climbing the mountain. So he's got his face set toward Jerusalem. They were amazed, and as they followed, they were afraid. What's this all about? Well, he's already told them what's going to happen at Jerusalem. They didn't fully understand it, but they got a little inkling. So I take it that they're amazed. Their master is going where he's going to face. He says he's going to face death and persecution, and they're going to mistreat him, and they're going to crucify him, and he's still going anyway. That's amazing. And then the closer they got, the more afraid they got, because they may be a little involved. In other words, if Jesus is going to be killed, what are they going to do to us? And so they're fearful of what they're going to face the closer they get to Jerusalem. And so, he took the 12 aside, and here's an important word, again. This isn't the first time he told them. Remember the dullness? We've been painting Mark 9, Mark 10, Mark 8, Mark 9, now Mark 10. Three chapters painting this picture. Took him aside and told him again what's going to happen to him. And so, he says, I'm going to be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes. They'll condemn me to death. They'll deliver me to the Gentiles, and they'll mock me and scourge me and spit on me and kill me, and the third day I'll rise again. Now, what does Luke add that we don't see here? Luke adds that this fulfilled prophecy. Why isn't that mentioned here? Well, Mark is writing for a Gentile audience, and that wouldn't mean as much to the Gentiles as it did in the other accounts. Mark also said that they did not understand. And not Mark, Luke mentions that, I'm sorry. Luke mentions they didn't understand, hence the dullness we've been painting. Does that make sense? So here we're painting a picture over and over again. The disciples ain't getting it. They don't get it about the nature of the kingdom, etc. They're just not getting it. All right, let's see if we can get through the rest. Let's talk about the request by James and John for a special place in the kingdom beginning at verse 35. We have Matthew's account of that, and Luke doesn't talk about it. So we only have one parallel account for what that may be worth to us. That's not ready for that. So let's talk about this request. Matthew's account says, who asked the question? The mother asked. But Mark's account says, the sons asked. So who asked? Yes. They both asked. The mother must have asked, and they asked as well. Now you might flag verse 35. They came saying, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. That is the exact opposite of the spirit and the attitude of service. Master, we want you to do for us. Not, we will do for you whatever you want. We want you to do for us. We're quite often the same way. Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we ask you. Now, I know you told some things in your word I'm not going to do, but I want you to do for me what I ask you. Opposite of service. Now, let's go. We need to hurriedly get through this. We've got about 5 minutes to see if we can get through. And so he said, what do you want me to do? Well, one sit on the right hand, one sit on the left. And Jesus' response to that at verse 38 is, you don't know what you're asking. This is giving us, he's pointing again to their dullness and their misunderstanding of the nature of the kingdom. And here's the point of this is a lesson on humility and service. So he said, can you be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? Talking about suffering is what he's talking about, verse 38 and 39. And they said they could do that. Well, he said, it's not, look at verse 40. It is not mine to give. In other words, this sitting on the right hand and the left doesn't come by assignment. It's not awarded by favor or some earthly consideration. It's by character. And so he deals with the character now. Now notice verse 41, the tension between the disciples suggests there's some carnal rivalry. We saw that in the discussion of who's the greatest. I'm trying to flag some, tie some things together, lace them together for what it may be worth. So what's the point through the rest of verse 2, verse 45? What's Jesus saying here? Yeah, the Gentiles, the pagans, are those that are interested in exercising authority, but it's not so among you. If you want to be great, you're going to be a servant. King James says minister. And whoever decides to be first shall be a slave of all. And just as he himself was a servant, he gives a lesson about servitude is what he does. Now, I want to quickly notice the whole context deals with the nature of the kingdom. It's a spiritual kingdom, not an earthly kingdom, as we just saw here. The citizens must be humble and submissive. We saw that back at verse 13. It may cost you the right of marriage. It may cost you material riches, like in the rich young ruler. It may cost you relationships, father and mother, son or daughter. It may cost you a place of service. In other words, it's not power and prominence, but it's a place of service in the kingdom. They misunderstood the nature of the kingdom. And this whole chapter drives at that. Does that make sense? Now let's talk about Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus. Try to harmonize some accounts. Matthew's account mentions two, and so does Luke's account. Now, Luke picks this up again, but Mark mentions just one. And so how many were there? There were two blind men, but Bartimaeus may have been the better known. There's another variation of the accounts. One account says that he was coming into Jericho. Another one says he was going out of Jericho. Mark says he was coming in and going out. And so what is that? Well, I take it, as Linsky observes, they've made their way down to Jericho here. And as Luke's account suggests, the next event that's recorded is Zacchaeus. So he must have come into Jericho, leaving Jericho, and he's called back to the house of Zacchaeus. So he both was leaving but coming back into Jericho. So that's the harmony, as Linsky, I think, does a better job harmonizing that than anybody. But he's probably making his way back into Jericho when he comes across blind Bartimaeus. Now, what's the point to be made from this story? I think it's perhaps to contrast his faith, his understanding, to that of the disciples. The placement of it seems to be arguing that. It's a case of a miracle, obviously, but what's the point of the story being told right here? To me, in both Matthew's account, I'll have to go back and look at Luke's account, but in Matthew's account and in Mark's account, the placement seems to contrast this man with great faith crying out to the disciples who were lacking in faith. Does that make sense? Time is gone. Questions? They had great faith. Lot in Mark 10. Lot in Mark 10. We're done.